The Japanese cinema is still a largely undiscovered landscape for American cinephiles. While we may know a few of the iconic filmmakers like Kurosawa and Ozu, or films like The Seven Samurai or Tokyo Story, there remains aesthetic and cultural barriers to cross if we're to enjoy a broader survey of what Japanese cinema has to offer. A new set of documentary films by the famed director Shohei Imamura is a good place to start exploring. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Shohei Imamura is, if known at all in this country, is most likely known for his narrative films like The Insect Woman, Vengeance is Mine, or The Ballad of Narayama. But he was also an accomplished and driven documentary filmmaker. Icarus Films has recently released six of Imamura's documentaries in a DVD set titled A Man Vanishes, and joining me to discuss these films is Marty Gross, filmmaker and consultant on many Japanese films released on home video in the U.S. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to mention you're joining us by phone from your office in Toronto. You're a bit of a globe hopper with all of your interests, but I want to thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to chat about this amazing box set of documentary films. Perhaps the place to start is to say that A Man Vanishes is the lead documentary of six on this box set. And if you could sort of help us summarize kind of what A Man Vanishes is as a film and as a story.
Well, A Man Vanishes is one of the most extraordinary films, that one will ever see, I believe, because it's a mix of, and it's a totally confusing mix of documentary and fiction. Imamura set out to explore why men disappear in Japan, particularly. There's a whole phenomenon of men just disappearing from the social circuit of which they're to which they're supposed to be connected, and for reasons of money and love and all sorts of reasons, people seem to disappear, and it's quite a phenomenon in Japan even till today.
Amazing.
And he set out to document 26 cases of different men who had disappeared. He thought that would be the film, but as he got into learning more about the story of this Tadashi Oshima, through meeting the fiancée that Oshima abandoned, Hayakawa, he realized that her story was enough. And he sets out in the film to make us think we're really watching a documentary. At the end, in the most explosive sequence at the end, we realize finally that this whole work has been completely fictionalized, although based on a true story.
Although based on a true story and with a number of actual non-actors, I presume?
Non-actors who participated in telling the story, and including the director, who's the key player in the story.
Yeah, it's fascinating how much, not only in this film, which bridges that gap, as you say, between fiction and nonfiction, but also in his truly documentary films, the other five films on the box, that the degree to which the filmmaker inserts himself, and you see sound people, you see cameramen, you see the director himself leading most of the interviews.
Well, I think Imamura, whom I never met to my regret, was a man of tremendous curiosity, and he didn't have patience to sit on the sidelines and watch somebody else do the interviews, and he realized very quickly that the best way to get the information that he wanted was to go and do it himself. And he says this in an interview that we translated for Icarus, or at least an article that we translated for Icarus Films on this occasion, that as he was doing the investigation, he realized that he would be the best person and the fastest person to get the information that he required. So he inserts himself in the film, and he does it very beautifully, really.
You know, you're right. It's an extraordinary film, and sitting down to watch six Japanese documentaries, you're not quite sure what to expect. But I have to say, once this one started, I was just bolt upright for the entire, and it's very long, 130 minutes, but it's a fascinating mystery. It's basically a documenting an investigation. It keeps branching off as it goes, and finally ends up being about two sisters and their rivalry, and whether or not the older sister, who's may have had a relationship with the vanished man and betrayed her younger sister, and the interview that takes place is as riveting as any police procedural you will ever see.
Imamura notoriously said, "I like to make messy films." And when he starts out with A Man Vanishes, you think that it may be a very simple story. The man's trying to escape because he'd stolen some money and he needed to disappear because he couldn't pay it back. And then he had this girlfriend. He has to get away from the girlfriend. But as it goes on and on and on, you realize that this is a much more complex story, what people remember, what people fail to remember, and what people think they saw, what people think they didn't see. At the end, he asks the question very directly. He looks at the camera and he says, well, there's no truth, there's no fiction. Hmm. It's all the same.
Yeah, I think what I loved about it was how unneat it is. You'd never actually find the man who's vanished. You never fully know why, what may have motivated him, but you've really learned something about all the other characters in his life who are searching themselves for his motivations and telling their own stories.
The other films in the set, if you want to talk about them, all the films have a deep connection here because Imamura was interested in people who were not part of the society, who wanted to escape or who ended up escaping or who became outsiders for all sorts of reasons. A prostitute who was dragged to the Philippines to service Japanese army and refused to come back to Japan or just didn't feel she could come back to Japan. Soldiers who ended up hating the Japanese establishment because the Japanese establishment had lied to them by sending them off to a war that had no meaning. So Imamura had took tremendous interest in outsiders.
I guess this set of films is really from the 60s and 70s, and he seems driven it through all six. There is a central mystery in each one, oftentimes unsolved, but that drives the film. But they're, as you say, all about people who have vanished or at least removed themselves from a society, and he seems just really fascinated by that idea of not only the schism it may create between in relationships and families, but just the very notion, particularly I think in the Western world, you know, we don't fully appreciate just how bound Japanese society is one to the other, and this notion that someone would just opt out or not come back from war seems to drive a lot of what he does.
Well, there's an official Japan that tends to get presented for all sorts of reasons. I think it's partly because we like the version of Japan that we get to see much of the time, the salarymen, the hardworking people, people who are deferential, the office ladies, the polite and cute office ladies. But Imamura was interested in another side of Japan, the side of Japan that isn't part of official Japan, the rough and tumble part of Japan.
There's a marvelous film called The Pirates of Bubuan, which he goes down to the Philippines in the 70s to some obscure islands, and ostensibly, given the title, it's about pirates, but it's a 48-minute film where you don't meet any pirates until the last 8 minutes, and even then you're not quite sure the person he's interviewing is a pirate. But it's really about the idea of piracy, how it's changed or affected a culture there, how a certain group of people have become just, in the view of some islanders, lazy and don't care because they feel like anything they do will just be taken from them by pirates. And it's really an ethnographic study of how these people live, and the piracy is just around it, but it's not the central thing that you think it's going to be. And I guess most of his films start out, you think this is a film about a guy who vanished and we're going to solve this mystery, or you think it's going to be about these pirates, and it ends up his interest just takes you down a whole other set of roads and tributaries.
Well, Imamura was never interested in simple answers to anything. He was interested in asking a lot of questions, and these questions added tremendous vitality to his work. I mean, long though it is, A Man Vanishes is gripping from beginning to end.
I guess the first clue for viewers is just the way it's edited together. There are these amazing insertions of a medium, a spiritual medium that this family goes to try to connect with the spirit of of this vanished man and try to discover why he's gone. And she keeps popping in at unusual times, and the way he edits sound with image is very unique. And, you know, it's almost like an avant-garde experimental film noir, I think, watching. I was trying to think, these films, I gather, were made for television?
Man Vanishes was made as a feature film. These were not made. The others were made for television.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the short films, the documentaries were made for television.
I was just trying to...
on TV, but I'm not entirely sure.
You know a lot about Japanese culture and Japanese film. I'm just wondering, in 1967, when A Man Vanishes came out, I was trying to put myself in the place of a theatergoer seeing this for the first time in 1967, you know, how that would connect to the other types of films that were coming out in Japanese cinema at that time.
Well, this was a period of downturn of Japanese cinema, of course, because television was making inroads. people wanted to stay, you know, were just staying home watching television, which was there and on all day. And so the Japanese cinema world was really struggling to figure out what to do. And on the one hand, the larger studios, Toho, Shochiku, Daiei, were making, you know, widescreen, CinemaScope, ToHoScope, grand masterworks that you like to think of them in order to attract audiences because it was going to be bigger and more colorful than what you had on TV. And on the other side, there were people who were just making short, not short necessarily, but making these energetic, strong energetic films. And I don't know what the audience for this would have been, but it's I think it probably shocked people.
He would have been considered part of the Japanese new wave of directors.
He's considered part of the new wave, but I think he's very much an outsider because everything he does is so idiosyncratic. You have Nagisa Oshima, who also made wonderful documentaries for television, none of which have ever been released outside of outside of Japan. But those were more on social subjects. He attacked a particular social subject, usually, such as the treatment of Koreans in Japan or other Korean citizens of Japan or other subjects like that. But in this case, I don't know enough about the how these films might have been received. But I would say that he's not exactly part of the Nouvelle Vague, as they call it in Japanese.
To use a French term for
of Shinoda and Hani and Oshima. But he's idiosyncratic enough. And he was also the type of guy who was never a member of anything, never wanted to be a member of anything. He says this repeatedly.
Well, you certainly get the sense in all of his films, which are dealing with people on the margins or investigating people who have opted out, that he has great sympathy and interest in those stories, and that personally, you know, he may see himself as you say, one on the outside or on the edge doing his own thing. And the studio he initially worked for, Nikatsu, I gather in the 60s, was also specialized in kind of, budget-conscious Yakuza films and had some real flowering of unusual types of film. I guess I'm thinking of Seijin Suzuki's career there, which ended around this time, and just the crazy, anachronistic films he was making. It seems that Imamura at that time thought, well, maybe documentary is where I can express myself right now instead of making crime films at Nikatsu.
Well, he formed his own company, Imamura Productions, which still exists, to make Man Vanishes. And then I guess he was supporting himself to some extent. His wife was supporting him during that period, I believe. And he was supporting himself to whatever extent possible by making television documentaries. I think that he was impatient, Imamura. He wanted to do everything himself, and he wanted to do everything quickly. And that documentary medium allowed him to do that. You know, you can't really go much further away from Japan than the Philippines and Thailand and to make these documentaries, and no one was supervising him, probably, like that.
You know, if we pull way back from these films and just look at the documentary form, I certainly think in this country there's a notion that to be a great documentary filmmaker, you remove yourself as much as possible from a film. You become, in some ways, vanished from the project. He is really taking that on straight on, that he and his crew, I don't want to say there's an artifice to it, but he's acknowledging that you cannot show up with a director, sound people, lighting, cameras, and stick them in everyday citizens' faces and expect to get a transparent, authentic view of what you as a person would have if you were just standing there talking to them. That the process itself changes the work.
Well, as I said, maybe differently a few minutes ago, we asked Tadao Sato, the great Japanese critic, to write an article about the origin of documentaries in Imamura's work, and he says in the booklet that we've got in this DVD box set that Imamura wanted to, make films the simplest possible way by himself. He thought he was the best person and the fastest person to get what he wanted. And rather than standing at the sidelines and trying to create something from a distance. And he also, and I think that he's very effective in the film. I mean, the way he interviews people and the way he connects with people while at the same time asking them very blunt and very direct questions, particularly in the case of Karayuki-san, The Making of a Prostitute, is remarkable. But he seems to be trusted by everybody.
Yeah, And it's really made me rethink the notion, you know, we typically use the term narrative to mean fictional films, stories that are scripted and have actors and such. Every one of these documentaries, I felt, was a narrative film.
Very much so, very much so. Partly because you're being introduced to characters. He's very gifted at finding extraordinary people to interview and to deal with. Each one of these people that he interviews, in the maybe partly because their lives have been so extraordinary, but he turns ordinary people, I guess, if they are ordinary, into fantastic subjects.
Yes. Are there a bunch more Imamura documentaries out there waiting to be released?
I think there are one or two more that were not included in this box set. I can't remember the names. I'm sorry.
But this is the majority of what he did in that format?
Yeah, because he went back. The next feature film that he made after this was The Profound Desire of the Gods, which he made in... he made Profound Desire of the Gods after A Man Vanishes, and then these documentaries, and then he made Vengeance is Mine, which is a remarkable work of fiction as well.
Do you have a favorite documentary by Imamura?
Well, I think A Man Vanishes is incomparable.
I would have to agree, and you know, I feel like I've really added a whole new chapter to my understanding of Japanese film and even culture, so I thank you for speaking with me today, and I know you put some effort into this box set as well, so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I've been discussing Icarus Films' recently released documentary film set titled A Man Vanishes, which includes six films by Japanese director Shohei Imamura. My guest today has been filmmaker and Japanese film scholar Marty Gross. For more information on the films and work of Marty Gross, log on to martygrossfilms.com. More on A Man Vanishes and other Icarus Films releases can be found at IcarusFilms.com. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.